I invite you to turn back to that passage that was read to us a few moments ago, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 15 through 27. Having just heard these verses read to us, I just can't help but think that if the Apostle Paul had been with us here in these last few moments, that probably his voice would have been the loudest of all, singing the greatest gift. Now, we may have been a little puzzled because he would have been singing in either Aramaic or Hebrew, but nonetheless, I think he would have been singing loudly about the truths of the gospel, and certainly another example here in this particular text of how thoroughly gripped Paul was with the message of Jesus Christ. Someone that I quote often is the name D.A. Carson or Don Carson. Dr. Carson is the chairman of New Testament at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and he is probably, in most people's estimation, the preeminent New Testament scholar in North America. When I am dealing with a New Testament text, and if there's something problematic or confusing or something to do with the language, which is very difficult to sort out, when I start to consult scholars and other Bible teachers and pastors, he's the first one that I go to. And I'm not alone. But in a very non-academic way, I read something that Dr. Carson had included in one of his books, which I thought really pertained to what Paul is communicating to the Corinthians and to us this morning. Because Dr. Carson shared about a friend of his who was a minister in the Church of England. And this minister had been invited to address a student group up at a university in Scotland. And he went up, and the people who were planning the event speaker come to present some aspect of the Christian message, they were expecting about 75 people. But as it turned out, there were Muslims on the campus that heard about it and were interested in knowing about what Christians believed. And so about 75 Muslims flooded into the auditorium. So it was really a group of 150, with half of them being Muslims. Well, the people sponsoring the event had already decided to have some music at the beginning to kind of warm up the crowd, and so they did a few Scottish ballads, which they usually enjoy in Scotland because a lot of Scottish ballads kind of poke fun at the English, which these ballads did, even though their speaker was from England. But then they decided to do one or two Christian songs, and the first Christian song they led the group in singing was "Awake, O Zion, come, clothe yourselves with strength." Well, at the mention of that lyric, the 75 Muslim students got up and walked out. Because certainly Zion is equated with the Jewish faith and with the promises of God as they understand them concerning Jerusalem, and we know what a controversial area of the world that is. Now, I don't think, and neither did Dr. Carson, that these students were being malicious. It was just a matter that they didn't think. They didn't think about how this would be received by those who were there as inquirers. And if you listen carefully to the verses that were read to us from chapter 9, verses 15 through 27, Paul was continually looking and assessing at how he could strategize and go about sharing the gospel, and all the while doing all that he could to remove anything that would be a hindrance to someone hearing and understanding and hopefully embracing the Christian message. Now, verse 15 kind of starts off mid-thought because it's begins the sentence, "But I have used none of these things." Well, the "none of these things" is what we looked at last Sunday morning in verses 1 through 14, where Paul is boldly asserting his own rights and the rights of all Christian workers to receive financial support in exchange for ministering to and among people. And he gives a very clear argument and gives four reasons why it is right to support those in Christian work. Thus, as I joked with one friend in an email this week, now that we've justified my paycheck, we can move on to verse 15. But Paul declares that even though he had this right, he chose not to exercise not only that right, but several others. The Apostle Paul absolutely refused to rely on the Corinthians for any of his necessary income. He voluntarily relinquished his rights in order to obtain what he calls a much greater reward. There were several goals that he had in mind, things that to him were a greater good. And he decided that by choosing to limit some of his own liberties, by forfeiting some of his own rights, including that right to be paid, that something greater was to be gained. And the first thing that he tells us in this passage that was to be gained was what he saw as the greater good of the gospel, as he describes it in verses 15 through 18. And as we look at Paul's statements here, we get an insight into his motive. His motive in what he said in verses 1 to 14 was not to solicit their financial support. In fact, he says, using hyperbole, "I'd rather die than do that." He does not want to nullify his arguments for why he chose not to receive money. Paul is concerned that as much as it depends on him, that he is able to remove every possible encumbrance to the preaching and the receiving of the gospel. Even though he has the right to a paycheck, he also knows that an appeal for money can raise suspicions about people's motives. And there were those in the first century, as in our own day, who do use the ministry as a way of lining their own pockets. Thus, Paul's practice almost everywhere he went and when he planted churches was to, as much as possible, use his own trade of working with leather and being a tent maker in order to provide his income, so that typically the only money he would accept from people was the money he was collecting to take back as an offering to give to people who were in need. Paul wanted to be able to look anyone in the eye and say, as he did to the Ephesian elders, and I think we read this text last Sunday morning and had it on the screen, he reminded the Ephesian elders, "I have coveted no one's silver, gold, or clothes. You yourselves know that these hands ministered to my own needs and to the men who were with me." No, his motive for ministry was not financial, but rather, as he states, that he was under compulsion. Verse 16, he wrote, "For if I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I am under compulsion, for woe to me if I do not preach the gospel." See, Paul did not invent the gospel. The gospel message that he taught was not the product of his own human ingenuity. Rather, it was something he had received from Christ with the command that he was to go out. In fact, in Acts 9, as we read about his conversion there, God says he was to be a chosen instrument of God to go preach the gospel to the Gentiles. So Paul simply declared a message that he received from the Lord. I remember when I was in my second year of college at Santa Fe College, I had a history class, and the history class included the Roman Empire and the birth of Christianity. And I still remember my professor, when he came to the Apostle Paul, explaining how Paul was a very clever man, that he was from a Jewish background, very educated, very trained. As he looked at the religious landscape, he thought, you know, we need to have a religion that involves not only Jew, but also Gentile. One that appeals to all people and tries to blur distinctions and separating people based on ethnicity or race or gender. And so Paul put this together and started to peddle this, and it caught on. And that was his view of the Apostle Paul. I respectfully, at the end of the class, asked if I could have 10 minutes to give a rebuttal, which he did allow me. And for 10 minutes, I just quoted a lot of other famous scholars and brilliant people through history who had a different view of how the Christian gospel came to be. Of course, I went to Santa Fe College back in the days when they had temporary quarters at abandoned high schools and abandoned hotels. All my friends that I lived with in college used to tease me, don't drive by slowly in front of Santa Fe, they'll throw a diploma in the window. You know, that kind of thing. No longer true, since they were just ranked by the Aspen Institute as one of the top 10 two-year colleges in the nation. But not so when I was there. But he has this compulsion, and he says, woe is me if I don't share this message. Because he was drafted. He had a stewardship entrusted to him. And so he says, if I do this voluntarily, there's a reward or pay. But the way the NIV puts it, he says, if I preach voluntarily, I have a reward. If not voluntarily, I'm simply discharging the trust that was committed to me. Because a steward is someone that is given an assignment by the master, and the steward is obligated to fulfill the wishes and the commands of the master. And that's how he saw himself, as one who was entrusted with the gospel, and thus he was compelled to preach. But he also saw that there was a reward in sharing the gospel. And what's the reward in verse 18? He actually gives a play on words here in the original language when he wrote it. Basically, what he's saying is, my pay is to do it without pay. That's what he's saying. My pay is to do it without pay. To offer the gospel at no cost to his hearers. What then is my reward, Paul would say? Just this. When I tell the good news, I won't let it cost anybody anything, and so I won't take advantage of any right in telling the good news. So it was the greater good of the gospel that Paul decided to exercise and to relinquish certain rights. But there's another greater good that he touches on in verses 19 to 23, and that is the greater good of the lost. And he uses interesting language here. He's talking about he has submitted himself to a voluntary servitude. He has decided that he's going to be enslaved to all men. I'm pretty certain, along with a lot of other students of the Bible, that he's picking up on an Old Testament concept that he's applying to himself figuratively here. And the Old Testament concept that I'm referring to is one that we find in the book of Exodus. And we read in Exodus chapter 21 this provision for the people of God. If you buy a Hebrew slave, he shall serve for 6 years, but on the seventh he shall go out as a free man without payment. So if a Hebrew ended up having another Hebrew slave in the seventh year, they were obligated to free them. But then there was another provision that Moses adds. But if the slave plainly says, I love my master, my wife and my children, I will not go out as a free man. Then his master shall bring him to God. Then he shall bring him to the door or the doorpost. And his master shall pierce his ear with an awl and he shall serve him permanently. The point there is that the Hebrew slave who is about to be free has the right to go ahead and commit himself to enslavement. He's not required to, but he chooses to because of his love for the master. That is what Paul has in mind here when he says, I enslave myself to all men. He has decided that he wants to have a disposition to where he gives of himself to the extent that he is serving men and women. A voluntary servitude. But then his comments in verses 20 and 21, 22, we see that Paul has a flexible methodology. And he mentions three ways that he's adapted himself. And the first that he mentions in verse 20 is he says to Jewish people, I became a Jew. Now, Paul has already stated in plenty of other places, and it's at the heart of the gospel message, that you're no longer required to follow the ceremonial law of the Old Testament. That once you're under the era of grace with the gospel message, but he realizes that when he's talking to Jewish people, they're still very much steeped in that mindset. And so he just doesn't cast all that aside, but rather he willingly practiced and participated in certain aspects of Judaism, not because he had to, but because he wanted to maintain a credibility and a hearing with his fellow Jews. And it would give him an open door to talk about Jesus. That's why, even though in some of his writings, Paul makes clear that it's no longer required that a person be circumcised to be a child of God, what does he do with Timothy? He enlists Timothy, a younger man, to travel with him on his missionary journeys as a part of the entourage. And Timothy had a Jewish mother and a Greek father, so he was uncircumcised. So Paul went ahead and had him circumcised. Now we stop, well, wait, I mean, is he contradicting himself? No. If he's going to take someone as a part of the missionary band and travel these hundreds and thousands of miles, and with their practice of always first going to the synagogue in every city, rather than just having that be a distraction, well, one of your guys is not even circumcised, just go ahead, Timothy, and be circumcised. Not because you have to, but just to remove that obstacle or that hindrance from my fellow Jews hearing the gospel. Over in Acts, that was in Acts chapter 16 that we find Timothy circumcised. In Acts 21, we see that Paul submits to some ceremonies of purification for himself, which was not required for him any longer, but he did it so the Jews wouldn't have reason to just out of hand reject him. So Paul was flexible in his strategy and his methodology. And by the way, this point that we're looking at here, verses 20, 21, and 22, this has become sort of the standard. This has become the template, the model for many, many missionary organizations and for many people involved in evangelism. That they believe that if you're going to be effective in sharing your faith, whether in a foreign culture or even in your own, that you've got to adapt to where people are. He was flexible in his strategy and his methodology, but he was not flexible in the content of the message. And that's an important point to remember. Well, the second example of adaptability that he gives in verse 21, when he's with the Gentiles, those are the ones without the law. The ones with the law are Jews who have the Old Testament or living by it. The ones without the law are non-Jewish people, Gentiles. And he says that he's with the Gentiles. He's making sure people don't conclude that he's being antinomian, that is, that he's against the law. He's not. But he's accommodating himself to them. He's going to rub shoulders with Gentiles. He's going to eat with them. And when he goes and has dinner with a Gentile family, he goes ahead and has a ham and Swiss sandwich without any problem of conscience. Jews don't eat meat and dairy mixed, in case you missed that. So he's flexible in his practices, but not in his principles. Third example, verse 22, is he said, I became weak to the weak. I believe that the weak he's speaking of, and please recall chapters 8, 9, and 10 hang together as a unit, starting with the issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols, and the weak are the people that he described back in chapter 8, verse 7. However, not all men have this knowledge, but some being accustomed to the idol until now eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. Remember when he spoke about those weak brethren? Well, those are the weak that he's being sensitive to that he mentions here. This idea of adapting to a culture or to individuals, I don't know if he was the first, but I think he's probably the first famous one. Some of you will recognize the name Hudson Taylor. Hudson Taylor may have been the very first missionary. He was English by birth, a graduate of the College of Surgeons in London, was medically trained, had a burden for China, and he went to China and established what became known as the China Inland Mission. He lived and ministered in China for 51 years. During his time there, he oversaw the establishing of 125 schools, over 300 mission stations. This was mainly through the 1800s and into the early 1900s. One of the ways that he was able to make an entree into the Chinese culture, and some of his supporters back home in England thought he was a little off with this, he started dressing in Chinese clothes. He started wearing his hair longer, like the Chinese men did, and he just began to adapt to the culture and to live the way they did in their food and their dress and some of their just practices in day-to-day living. And this is part of what enabled him to have such a significant ministry in China. Of course, all of the Christian missionaries were expelled under the communist dictate of Mao Zedong in the late 1940s. And one of my professors in seminary actually was one of the last missionaries to be expelled from China. He was there with the China Inland Mission. But whether it's the weak, whether it's the Gentile, whether it's the Jew, don't miss what Paul's motivation is for adapting and for enslaving himself. And I realize that there are some folks who may be uncomfortable with Paul's his chameleon strategy. You know, the chameleon can kind of change its color depending on its environment. Paul embraced a chameleon strategy on non-essential things. But don't miss why he's doing it. What does he say at the end of verse 20 about the Jews? That I might win those. What does he say at the end of verse 21 about those Gentiles? That I might win those who are without law. What does he say about the weak in verse 22 at the end of the verse? That I may by all means save some. That's why he's doing this. And so where we live now, it seems to me that where the rubber hits the road for us here in 2013 is, what is it that we are doing to remove encumbrances, to try to adapt to unbelievers that we know, and what is it that we do to establish a point of connection? We need to be praying and strategizing in our own hearts and minds and looking for ways to establish connections with unbelievers in order that you might have an entree to tell them the most important news they'll ever hear in their entire life. I try to pray and think this way with people that I come in contact with. A few months ago, I came across a Rolex watch that Priscilla's father had left in some of his belongings when he died. I was pretty sure it wasn't a real Rolex, because I think he bought it in a parking lot or something, off somebody selling it out of the back of their car. But I thought, well, I'm going to take it to a watchmaker. So I went to the watchmaker shop here at the Oaks Mall, and they opened it up, and sure enough, it was a bogus Rolex. But as the guy was taking it apart, he was a young man, about 30, and he was tinkering with the watch. I was thinking, okay, he's a watchmaker, and so I thought, you know, how can I strike up a conversation? I said, you know, have you ever heard of Corrie Ten Boom? He said, no. I said, well, you know, she was the first female licensed watchmaker in all of the Netherlands. Her father owned a watch shop, And she was the very first female, and her family were involved in hiding many Jews during the war from the Nazis. And he thought that was interesting, and so we had a brief conversation. I had dropped off another watch to be repaired to get a new crystal put on it, so I knew I was going back to see him in a few days, so I got a copy of the book, The Hiding Place, and when I went back, I said, remember I mentioned that female watchmaker? He said, yeah. I said, well, this is a book that kind of talks about her family's experience in the war. And so I gave it to him. I mean, just trying to find some point of connection, something that that person is interested in. As insignificant as it may seem, when Jeffrey and I are praying weekly in our staff meetings, we're praying for unbelievers that we're interacting with. And several times already, Jeffrey, you've mentioned specifically that when you're walking your dog or going to the dog park, other people who own dogs strike up conversations with you. What kind of dog is that? They're interested in that. And so it becomes a point of contact. Your children playing in Little League or at the Boys Club or in the soccer league or where you go to music practice or dance practice. You know, you go to recitals, you go to athletic events, you sit with these people. Look for some point of commonality. Adapt oneself. I think a lot of times it's not that we don't want to, it's just we forget to think about it. Now, I understand that there are some arenas where unbelievers reside that we don't want to enter that arena, and we shouldn't. I mean, I'm not going to go to Cafe Risque with an unbeliever just to get some time with them. I mean, there's certain choices that we're going to make and that we should make. But I would caution you about this. There are some believers that feel comfortable stepping to arenas that other Christians are very judgmental. And I think, you know, you've got to be careful about being judgmental just because that person feels free to go into a bar. And, in fact, I know a young man that up in Savannah started a thing called Theology on Tap. And it's people who wanted to talk about the Bible, and they would get together in this room at this bar in Savannah. They'd all have a beer, and he had Grudem's Theology, and he would lead a lesson. There was Christians and non-Christians in the group. Now, I know there's some Christians would say, well, hey, that's wrong. But you know what? I don't believe it is, not if we look at the example of Jesus. What was Jesus always criticized for? The kind of people he hung around with and the places he went. We've got to exercise discernment, and we have to know ourselves about what we can deal with in terms of temptation or not. But, you know, to live this way, to live the way Paul's talking and always strategizing, adapting oneself, looking for the entree to share the good news of Christ, it takes diligence. It takes self-control. You must train oneself to live and to think that way. And in fact, that's the very thing he moves to as he mentions the final greater good that's to be gained about him relinquishing his rights and to think this way, and that's the greater good of an imperishable reward. And that's what he addresses in verses 24 through 27. Living with that kind of posture demands personal discipline, and then he decides to use the example, just like the personal discipline that an athlete has to engage in. He obviously has in mind, when he talks about running the race in verse 24, about getting the prize, he has the Grecian Games in mind. Now, we all know the Olympics. That's the most famous of the Grecian Games. But you may not know, historically, there was another set of games that were also very famous in ancient Greece, and they took place in Corinth, and they were called the Isthmian Games. Because remember, I should have brought that slide today, but remember, Greece is two bodies of land connected by a very narrow isthmus. They called them the Isthmian Games. And like many of those ancient Greek games, they competed, and then, of course, the prize was some kind of a wreath that was placed on their head, a reward, a crown, if you would. For the Isthmian Games, those athletes trained and did nothing but that for 10 months leading up to the games. The last month, they were actually in Corinth doing their final training, having been preceded by 9 months of training elsewhere. But it's not difficult to understand the point that Paul is making, and that if you're going to be competitive, you've got to exercise self-control. As he puts it, he runs as to win. There's a goal that's in front of him that prompts him to want to press on. What was it? Just a couple of weeks ago, this woman in her 60s kind of gained the attention of, I guess, the world. She went into the water in Cuba, came out of the water in Key West. Diana Nyad, you know, swam that 100 and something miles from the one shore to the other. Well, she has done other long-distance swims over her lifetime. In fact, she had tried four times previously over the last 30 years to do that same swim and was kept from it either by weather or whatever else, that she had not succeeded the first four times. But she swam all the way around Manhattan, and she's done other long swims. But sometimes she practices swimming 9, 15, and 24-hour swims. Talk about diligence. That's what athletes do if they want to train, if they want to compete well. Exercising discipline, self-control, engaging in the training that it requires, and running to win an eternal prize. See, when they ran in the games in ancient Greece, they got a wreath, a laurel wreath that was placed on their head. Those leaves eventually dried up and became disposable. The kind of wreath that Paul is running for and that we all should be running for is a wreath that is imperishable, is the way he describes it. So if the athlete wishes to excel, he or she willingly subjects themselves to the most rigorous diets, sleep, all kinds of restrictions, things they go without. It's always, I don't know why in particular, it's the gymnasts in the Olympics that when they interview them, especially the female gymnasts, right after they've done competing, ask what are they going to do. Usually they're going to go pig out somewhere because they've denied themselves for so many months. But there's something else that's pressing on Paul, and that's the idea that he wants to compete, he wants to be disciplined, but also he does not want to function in a way that is going to disqualify him. Did you notice his point there about there? That I myself should not be disqualified? King James Version actually says that I might not become a castaway. He does not want to reach a point where he's not approved. Now, I hope this goes without saying, but it's so important that I'm going to say it in case someone perhaps is misunderstanding. Paul is not suggesting here that his figurative language is referring to the status of his salvation. That's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about becoming disqualified so all of a sudden he's not going to make it into heaven. He's talking about the very thing that he was talking about earlier in the letter in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. In fact, the word he uses here about becoming disqualified, perhaps not being approved, is from the same root word that he used back in 1 Corinthians 3 when he said in verses 14 and 15, if any man's work which he has built upon it remains, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet as through fire. Remember in that chapter when we looked at it months ago, he was talking about the different building materials, and there's some things we build with that are shoddy and they don't stand the test, and other building materials last forever, gold, precious stones, as opposed to wood, hay, and stubble. That's the kind of approval and reward he's talking about still here in 1 Corinthians chapter 9. He doesn't want to do something that would somehow impinge upon the reward he wants to receive from the Lord Jesus Christ. Just a number of weeks ago, I think it was early August or end of July, there were the men's swimming world championships. I don't know if you saw any of that. It was in Barcelona, Spain. And the U.S. team was heavily favored, and rightly so, when it comes to the 4x100 swimming medley. Since Montreal Olympics in 1976, every world championship and every Olympic game and that medley swimming, the gold has been won by the American team except one time in 2007. Our own Ryan Lochte, Gator Ryan Lochte, was on this medley team. And as they were celebrating what they were sure was their victory, because they smoked everybody else in the pool on that, all of a sudden the signs flashing DQ. They were disqualified. I don't know if you saw that. And the disqualification was, as Kevin Cordes was on the block ready to dive in, as he hit the wall, he dove too soon by 1/100th of a second. Up to 3/100ths is okay. 4/100ths, you're disqualified. And that was the time he had, was the 4/100ths when he jumped. So here, there was this wonderful race, and then one small technical thing disqualified them, and France took the gold, and I forget who got the others. Paul doesn't want to do anything to be disqualified in his striving to honor the Lord and to fulfill his ministry. If you would, please turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 5. And also, if anyone competes as an athlete, he does not win the prize unless he competes according to the rules. Thus, he says back in Corinthians, verses 26 and 27, that he actually buffets his body. He just doesn't box like he's just boxing shadows. He's got something very specific in mind. And when he talks about buffeting his own body or pummeling his body, what he's referring to is what he wrote to the Romans, that we all have the capacity to either present our bodies as instruments of wickedness or to be instruments of righteousness. He says that in Romans 6:13. And so here he's saying, I want to present my body as an instrument of righteousness, and I train my body and treat it in a way that I'm always performing and behaving as I should. We have rightly sung this morning about the fact that we stand in right relationship to God based on his grace, not through any works of ours. That is the doctrine of justification, standing justified before God because of the merits of Christ that are applied to us. But don't make the disastrous mistake of thinking that this somehow creates a mentality of passivity in the Christian life. You are making a mistake if you think that being overwhelmed with the grace of God means that you just sit back and do nothing. Otherwise, so much of Paul's writings don't make any sense. Why does he say, I labor, I run the race, I strive, I toil, I endure? He doesn't do those things to be justified, but he does those things to be an active participant in the process of sanctification, of becoming more like Christ. So, in summary fashion, he says in verse 23, I do all things for the sake of the gospel, that I may become a fellow partaker of it. So what rights am I relinquishing? What rights are you relinquishing? How adaptable are you to non-Christians in order to have that open window? What is there that you do that you go out of your way in order to engage unbelievers? We addressed this subject, or Paul did, back earlier in the letter when he said, when I told you not to associate with the immoral, I did not mean the immoral of this world. You'd have to go out of the world. He said, I'm talking about those who are in the church who are claiming to be Christians that are living in an immoral way. Those are the ones you got to worry about. So what kind of training are you engaged in? Are you even on the track, or are you just sitting in the stands? Excellent book, Questioning Evangelism by Randy Newman. He has 13 chapters in that little book. Chapter 11 is entitled, The Question of Compassion, What If I Don't Care That My Neighbor Is Going to Hell? Chapter 12 is entitled, The Question of Anger, What If I Really Want My Neighbor to Go to Hell? But one of his conclusions in struggling with that is it's prompted him to get on his knees and ask God to break his heart for other people. And maybe that's what every one of us in this room needs to do before the day is out, is to seek God's face and ask him to help us have our hearts broken for people who don't know him. I don't know if you saw any of the interviews with Diana Nyad, but she was asked after failing four times why at this age was she attempting again to swim from Cuba to Florida. I don't know if any of you saw this. It was really very insightful. She said that her mom had died recently at the age of 82. And her mother's death created this kind of, I think she called it an existential angst. Because she said, I thought, I'm going to blink and I'm going to be 82 and then I'm going to be gone. And she said it prompted her to ask, what have I done with my life? What have I done for my community? As great a feat as it was, I don't know how significant that is compared to those kind of questions. While I swam from Cuba to Florida, I don't know what that does for the community at large, but I guess it inspires those of us in our 60s to not give up. But what has her swim gained her? Aside from the pride that comes from such an incredible accomplishment, and also all the naysayers that have come along questioning the legitimacy of it, if you've followed it. But what has that feat accomplished for her soul? For her eternal destiny? I'm going to ask you to turn to one more place, 2 Timothy chapter 4. Most Bible scholars believe that this is the last letter that the Apostle Paul wrote. It's written not long before his execution. Verses 7 and 8 of chapter 4. As he sees the end is near, he writes, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. And the future there is laid up for me, the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. When you read those words, do you resonate with that statement? Is it your hope, your aspiration? If not, maybe it's time to step back and reassess about what things are most important in life. Paul was about forfeiting rights for a greater good.